Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
Soccer Show and our latest foray into your listener questions. Today, we're looking at Gio Reyna's defensive capabilities, the Eagle-Seagull Derby, and we get granular on XG, which is just as fun as it sounds. My name's Ryan Bailey. Joining me today, a man who makes fun of John Mayer but likes Riff Raff, Taylor Rockwell. I am outing your musical taste at the top of the show.
Yeah, and I stand by it. I don't need John Mayer in my life. I do need Riff Raff from time to time. The man makes good workout music. He makes good running music. If you're doing manual labor and you feel yourself sort of draining, Riff Raff will get you back in gear. I guarantee you that. I don't endorse his fashion choices, his style choices. I don't plan to tattoo BET or Tweety Bird onto my body or get grills or anything like that. But maybe the pink braids. Maybe I'll get some pink braids at some point in my life.
I have one Riff Raff song on my running gym playlist, Taylor, and it's got this hilarious sort of spoken word bit at the beginning where he's like, put the windows down, shades down, bro.
I know that song. That song rules.
Yeah, it's a good it's amusing. But I would rather buy tickets to John Mayer if I were me, which I am me.
Here's the definitive thing about Riff Raff and other artists of his kind or style is that I wouldn't say I know the names of his songs, but I definitely, as soon as you play them, know at least some of the words to them. I think Carlos Slim, Peach Panther, Pink Panther, Vanilla Gorilla, Butterscotch Babe Ruth, those I can get for you. But outside of that, I start to struggle.
Oh, let's move on. Joining us,
are you sure?
I mean, we can go on Riff Raff a little longer if you like.
Dulce and Gabon. I only rock Dulce and Gabon. That's a solid one. I'll stop now.
Let's stop now. Let's introduce a man who's getting ready to talk about XG. He's flipping from 6 to midnight as we speak. Joe Lowry, hello!
Am I on the wrong show? What Zencaster link did I just join? I'm not sure that I want to be here anymore. No, it's on brand. It's on brand and off brand all at the same time for us. So I'm here for it, Ryan. I like it.
Well, I'm excited to talk about it. We have a big question about XG coming up, as I've previewed, and it's actually very interesting what we've found about that. I'm being sincere when we say that. And joining us, Joe, to discuss that and much more, a man celebrating a famous win for his miserable little country, Graham Ruthven. Congratulations.
Wow.
Still wearing your Scotland shirt today. A big win for Scotland over Spain yesterday evening as we record.
Thank you, Ryan Bailey. I mean, as Rodri cried afterwards, we were rubbish. Just a rubbish performance by Scotland. Not very good at all, not very memorable. I am shocked at the mention of John Mayer and Riff Raff, because I wasn't aware there are other songs in the world. I thought it was just a Super John McGinn song. I thought that was the only song in the whole world at this moment in time.
Well, there's the... that's the one, right? Is there any other Scottish ones you sing?
We sing about how... Flower of Scotland, yeah, sending Proud Edward's Army homewards. And Scott McTominay now has a song because all of a sudden he has turned into prime Zinedine Zidane and is going to win the Ballon d'Or, 4 goals in 2 games. So, yeah, there's a few songs now that we sing.
Very nice. Well, and that was a wonderful experience for you, Graham, which you've documented on the Patreon, of course, with a very good video from your time at Hampden Park. Patreon.com/Total Soccer Show if you want to check it out. Guys, I realise... the three teams that we follow as nationals on this podcast all won all of their games in this window. That's kind of cool, right?
Look at us, guys, going places.
Somebody in the Discord also pointed out a pretty positive aggregate scoreline across all these games as well for our respective national teams. So good work individually, good work as a unit, but especially good work to Scotland.
Yeah,
Graham, was that the biggest win of like your lifetime for Scotland? That you remember,
there was a big 0-0 win against England. What was that, a year or so ago?
We don't count games against smaller...
Don't let him make it about England, Graham.
We don't count games against pot two teams, you know. We're only caring about results against pot one teams like Spain, and, you know, we beat them. So, but yes, I think it is certainly one of the biggest results that I have been a Scotland fan for. I mean, we've beaten France, we've beaten the Netherlands in the past. So the thing about last night's game was... And this kind of speaks to what Rodri said about it being a rubbish performance. He's obviously talking about how much of the ball that Spain had, but where were your chances, Rodri? Like, they hit the bar once, and beyond that, it didn't feel like they were going to score. Scotland defended well, created chances, and threw in a little bit of poophousery, and I enjoyed every single minute of it. Maybe Spain should try some of that stuff, particularly the creating chances bit, because I've heard that that is important for winning football matches.
Good stuff. I do recommend listening. You check out Graham's video. My favourite part is when you're walking along outside the stadium and an excited gentleman could try to join in on a video and you said something like, what's the score going to be? And he went, oh, 7-0. And quick as a flash, Graham goes, yeah, to Spain probably, which didn't come to pass. So that was good.
I have a question about that. You all, I think, are much better. Graham in particular are better about doing those sort of walk and talks and not being self-aware. I promise I'm not trying to throw shade, but actually asking this question. I think as soon as I start to film myself in public, I'm aware that I'm filming myself in public and I feel like sort of a jerk. Are you all able to just like not think about that? Or is it because you're doing something for the Patreon, you're actually creating content that people will consume, that it makes a difference? How do you combat that?
I do sometimes feel like a little bit of a jerk YouTuber at times, particularly when I'm in a crowd of people. But it helps if you have a low opinion of yourself to begin with, which I do. So I don't really care what people think.
I just trust that the crowd of Gen Z TikTokers and YouTubers have paved the way for people like us. That's all it is. So you know what? In that moment, if they can go out there in public and do whatever it is that they're doing, then I can record a Patreon video. That's my perspective.
That makes sense. I think I would be just nervous around Hampden Park that they would look at me as a fraud because of my accent to begin with and because I'd probably call it soccer at some point, and then filming myself, that might put it over the top.
Yeah. The occasions I've done it, Taylor, I find it tremendously embarrassing as well, I must admit. Walking down the street, if I'm doing like going to or from the stadium, I'll make sure there's not someone right in front of me or right behind me so they don't have to listen in earshot to my nonsense. So.
My wife can always tell when I'm around.
We're not so lucky.
Yeah. No, we're not.
Got you.
Ryan wasn't ready for that burn. Ryan was not ready for that.
Oh, God. Both barrels today. I'm loving it. Let's get to our listener questions, shall we? Sunny Johnson has been in touch. I appreciate your psychological analysis of Gio Reyna. Do you believe, however, that he needs to learn how to play defense to be a true impact player for club or country? Taylor, you look like you want to answer this one first, big man.
Any question from Sade, I will answer. I cannot tell if the first part of that was sarcasm or not. I want to start there. I can't tell if the I appreciate your psychological analysis thing was real. I also can't say that I had many strong opinions on Reyna's defensive work before this question, which is why I really enjoyed it. I watched a bunch of footage from his recent games. I have concerns. I will add, I'm not sure like the defensive side of Gio Reyna's game is going to be the most important thing, the thing that defines him, even like one of his top 10 best attributes in terms of what clubs will be looking for. I also think I might be biased against him. I would just want to like own that up front. I don't know if it's the World Cup stuff. I don't know if it's the kind of body language stuff. But either way, I find him to be a frequently frustrating person or player when it comes to his body language. And I think that informed my understanding of his defensive work, because so much of what I saw from him is basically that he goes into 1v1s in a very particular way. He sort of runs at the person on the ball and will maybe go in for the tackle, but mostly he's kind of going at them, applying pressure. And if he is bypassed, if he doesn't win that challenge, he's kind of done. He kind of turns and walks back. Maybe he'll jog back. But there's not that intensity that I would maybe expect of a Dortmund player. It did make me wonder if this is part of the reason why we haven't seen him play for Dortmund so much this season. I don't think that defensive effort is there. And even in the El Salvador game, I saw a couple different times when he is he's pretty clear on who he's supposed to be marking and is just sort of jogging backwards until he realizes, like, oh, my guy's got the ball. I need to close him down. And even when he does, he gets cut twice and then starts walking again. And I think there are some limitations to his game. Again, I don't think that is meant to be the strongest point, but I do wonder if pressing teams, more sort of systematic teams when it comes to how they defend, are going to look at those shortcomings and have some questions about him.
Joe, your thoughts on this one? How important is the defensive side of his game?
I think that's the key part of this question, Ryan, and I'm glad you asked. I don't think I can accurately answer that question, but I do think we can maybe get a little bit closer to thinking about the trade-offs that you make in soccer, right, with when you select different players. Anytime you want to put a player on the field, you accept a trade-off, right? You get the thing that they're good at or the thing that they're supposed to be good at, and you miss out on the stuff that they don't do very well. We can think about this with Tyler Adams in a completely, like, reverse Gio Reyna way, where Adams is very, very good at defending, covers a bunch of ground. You know exactly what you're going to get from him in terms of effort and energy and disruptive ability. But what you don't get is any sort of attacking thrust. Like, Adams is a connector in midfield and not a great one at that. In my mind, he can play the ball forward, but he's not very good under pressure. And so with the defensive value that he adds, you're also risking some offensive challenges there. So that's one side of this. And you think about for Gio Reyna, we haven't seen Gio Reyna's attacking ability develop to the extent that Adams' defensive ability has developed. So you don't really get as much of the benefit with a player like Gio Reyna yet. You get it in flashes, you get it in spurts. You don't get it consistently for 90 minutes because he's either not fit or just not consistent enough as a young player. But the trade-off with Reyna is you're expecting to get some attacking quality and you're sacrificing some defensive work. Taylor, I think you're absolutely right. Like, Gio Reyna is not a very good defender. He doesn't always move around the field with a ton of urgency. He's kind of floppy in how he moves, like one of those car wash things that are outside every single car wash in
the
United
States.
The
wacky waving inflatable arm waving two men? Yeah.
Yes, those. Yeah, what you said. Like, he kind of runs like one of those players when he's not engaged. And so you do lose something. Like, if the U.S. want to integrate Gio Reyna into the lineup, particularly as a central midfielder, you're essentially losing, like, the mobility of Adams or Musa or McKennie and adding Gio Reyna in, which is a net loss defensively. Like, there's no other way around it. You have to cover for him somewhere. But I guess where I fall on this is I'm optimistic enough about what Gio Reyna brings in the attacking side that I know this is a wild comparison. Actually, I don't even need to make the Messi comparison. Just think about any elite attacking player in the world. Like, anybody that's bringing that kind of value, and Gio Reyna's not there yet, but any attacking player in the, like, top 3 percentile in the world is not bringing you above average defensive work. Like, those players are so, so rare. So if the U.S. think Gio Reyna can be good enough to change games for them, then I think he's worth trying to accommodate. And I think he's absolutely already a true impact player for the U.S., which is really what Sade was asking about.
Yeah, I think it's a key distinction there. First of all, I feel like I went after Gio Reyna in my response, so Joe took shots at Tyler Adams just to sort of balance the scales a little bit. I see what you did there, Joe. I think that's probably a fair point when it comes to the United States. I think you can, especially at international level, sort of balance your team such that you don't have to have everybody defending 100%. More so for me is the concern at club level, where I think about players like Mohamed Salah or Sadio Mane playing for Liverpool and then Mane even with Bayern, right up until he gets into fights with Nagelsmann. Both of them put in that defensive work, will do that running to, at the very least, sort of harass and frustrate and inhibit counterattacking opportunities or just genuine attacking opportunities. And I think you're right, Joe, that it's a lot of the way he runs, the sort of casualness that he seems to run on the defensive side. That's where I sort of see problems arising potentially if that isn't improved. I mean, maybe he goes to clubs where that's not as needed or there isn't this idea that the whole team is pressing and working really hard off the ball. But any team that is, I think that is a major red flag if you're considering signing him, at least right now. You're right, he's very young. That could very much change. I just was surprised by, if not the lack of effort, then the lack of intensity on the defensive side in a number of different games.
Yeah, it's not ideal, and nothing. I hope I didn't convey that it is ideal in my opening comments, because I would love
you
said
I love
to,
it, is what you
I,
said.
I love that Gio Reyna doesn't try defensively. Yeah, that's my favorite thing. I do think that immediately makes him, if you provide more defensive effort, like, that immediately makes you a more valuable player.
Mm-hmm.
I don't actually know what I think about the question I'm about to ask, but Graham, maybe I'll toss this to you. Do you think, I'm thinking about a club like Manchester City, right? Do you think that Bernardo Silva and Jack Grealish and Kevin De Bruyne, Do those guys provide, like, elite defensive effort? Do they provide significantly more than Gio Reyna? I'm open to the answer being yes. But, okay, so you think that they're, like, they're much more active defensively in the kind of movements that they provide without the ball?
If Gio Reyna is the benchmark we're using here, yes, I think Bernardo Silva, even Jack Grealish, and actually he's down in my notes as a player who has added defensive work rate and work ethic to his game after a move to another club. So at Aston Villa, obviously, he was their talismanic difference maker. The team was basically built around him. He didn't need to be that player. He moves to Manchester City, where everyone is expected to contribute on the defensive side of the ball. Even Erling Haaland this season, there's been some discussion. I know we're talking about players in very different positions here, but talking about the principle of you know, defensive work and contributing on the defensive side of the ball. Even Erling Haaland has had discussion around him this season on his work rate. So Jack Grealish is one of the players I look at, and he should offer some encouragement to Gio Reyna that in the right circumstances, with the right coach, at the right club, I still think he can add that to his game. Let's look at another American at a lower level, but Malik Tillman. At the start of the season for Rangers, it was the one biggest thing. I'm pretty sure I mentioned this on the show. Whenever Rangers faced a team that was ball dominant, Malik Tillman went completely missing. His work rate was a real problem. He got dropped from the team essentially for a while because of it. And now Michael Beale's come into Rangers. He's a manager who seemingly has been able to instill those things in Malik Tillman much better than Giovanni van Bronckhorst. And all of a sudden in European games and in Old Firm derbies, Malik Tillman is providing that work rate on the defensive side of the ball. So I agree with everything that's been said about Gio Reyna. My concern with Gio Reyna right now is if he's going to be in that central unit. I can't really think of a player in that position in world football that doesn't provide something on the defensive side of the ball. I mean, Jude Bellingham is a comparison you would make to a player who drives the ball forward in the way that Reyna might do for the US in the future. And Jude Bellingham provides plenty on the defensive side of the ball. So if he's moving into a central position, that is a concern for the US, and it's an area of his game that he would really need to work at.
Good stuff. All right, thank you very much, Sardi Johnson, for that question. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. I'll take Sardi over Riff Raff any day, though. Right, Taylor? Right?
Yeah. Sade. Sade is the artist you're going for.
There
Who
we
know
go.
If it's Sade, Sade, Sade. Could be anybody. Either way, I love this question because it made me think things I had not previously thought.
There we go. That's what it's all about, D-Rock. Let's get another question in from Derek, who says, I noticed in one of Graham's Patreon videos that he moves around quite a bit during matches. When watching as a fan, where do you prefer to sit in a stadium? Graham, before we get to this question, can I ask you something I also observe from your videos? And that is that you go to games alone quite a lot. Mm. Now, I am a stand for going to the movies, going to the cinema on your own, because I don't believe it's a social activity. You go and watch a movie.
Yeah.
I'm trying to normalize that. I do it all the time, or have done it all the time in the past. However, with soccer games, I can't recall ever going to one on my own. So what's that experience like? And do you tend to meet up with people while you're there? Yeah. How does it work?
So I did go to the Scotland game last night on my own, and not to get the small violin out, but that was essentially because I couldn't find anyone to go with. So I'd rather go to the game on my own rather than not go to the game. With Albion games, it's a bit different. I do go on my own, but I meet up with maybe six or seven other people there that I have been watching Stirling Albion games with for years.
Right.
So I'm certainly not alone when I'm watching the game. I'm talking to them while the game is happening. And last night I did kind of miss that in the first half, where I was kind of having frustrations with Aaron Hickey giving the ball away a couple times, and I ended up actually making pals with the people behind me, which you saw in the Patreon video when the second goal went in. So second half, I started kind of muttering to them some things. But yes, I last night I went on my own, but generally I will be watching the game with people that I know.
Okay, fair enough. And Graham, when you do go to a game, where is your preferred vantage point?
Yeah, so obviously sometimes you can't move around. Going back to Derek's question about how I move around quite a bit during matches, obviously sometimes you can't move around, like last night at Hampden when you buy your ticket and that is your seat, you stay put. But one of the best things about lower league football is how a lot of the stadiums allow you to move around. You can basically just walk around the entire stadium. I don't know, Ryan, I think League 2 might be a little bit a level above that, but maybe if you go down to like National League, I think some of those stadiums will be similar. So if your team is shooting towards a certain goal, you will go and stand behind that goal for that half, and then you go to the other end for the second half. I do enjoy that about lower league football. But if I have to pick a place to sit and stay there, it was pretty much exactly where I was at Hampden last night, which was at one of the corner flags. I guess my theory is that you still get a decent view of the match itself being somewhat along the touchline. But then if a goal scored, you've got a 50% chance of being close to it. And then also, crucially, players celebrate goals in corners of pitches.
Oh.
So there's always good fun there if there's a goal scored and they're celebrating right in front of you. So I tend to go... Basically, if you've seen my Patreon video from last night, that would be my optimum position.
Wow. I did not see that answer coming. Taylor, I thought that the corner position would be the least favourable. It's interesting for me, Taylor, because... Obviously, the most atmosphere generally at stadiums is with the ultras or the fans behind the goal, but maybe not perceived as the best vantage point for taking in the game.
Yeah, especially if you're sitting directly behind the goal, you are then going to be in that supporter section. It is going to be a lot about creating the atmosphere, creating the vibe. I think sometimes less so what is fully happening on the pitch, the tactics, the instructions, the adjustments, and more so the big events, you're going to get those in that supporter section. I think sitting just to the side of the supporter section, that's what we did for the Sporting Kansas City game. I think that's a kind of perfect blend of you can see the tactics, you can see how the play is developing, but you are near the atmosphere. When there's a goal scored, you get the smoke going off, and it does give you that sort of combination. But to be honest, my answer was up and in the corners. So there you go. Graham and I, are similarly aligned on this one, because I think it gives you the sort of best of both worlds. Right behind the goal, but up, you can see just straight down the pitch. So you can see how play is developing, how the tactics are changing. In the corner, I think you can still do that, but you can get a better sense of the offside line, how high those lines are pushing on either side. And then, yeah, you get the celebrations too. So I think that's where I tend to prefer to sit. Also because midfield seats for U.S. sporting events are, you know, $7,000 or whatever. So they get a little bit too pricey at the same time.
Did I see the All-Star tickets are like $300?
Yes, you did.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Which
that's
is,
all I have to say.
Which I would say is ridiculous in a number of ways. It's also the problem of hosting an All-Star game at Audi Field, which does not have a big capacity. It's a small stadium, and it's small even in the way that it's kind of on the ground. The main concourse is on the ground. You walk in from the ground floor, you stay on that level, you walk around it, you go up into your seats for the most part. But like, I don't think there's much space there, whereas like the Atlanta All-Star game, you can sell that thing out and you get what, like 60, 70,000 people in there. So I think it is a strange place to do it. I think the limitations of the venue make it hard to get decently priced seats.
All right, Joe, we've had two votes for basically in the corner, which by my count was the worst of both worlds because you can't quite see the offside and you're not behind the goal. What do you think, Joe?
Joe wants to be in a blimp above the stadium so he can see all the
I want to be in my
stuff.
Floating stadium above the actual on-the-ground stadium to lure everyone up to my floating stadium. Sorry, Ryan, did you just say you can't see the offside line in the corner, which is true? Is that something you care about seeing when you're in person?
Yes. Yes.
Ryan needs, you got to check the AR? Is that what you're doing?
Well, if you want to get to my answer, I always think sitting on the halfway line is the very best. Like, my family's tickets for Wimbledon are on the halfway line. They always were back at Selhurst Park back in the day and Plough Lane back in the day before that. I don't mind sitting behind the goal because I think you get the best, you tend to get the best atmosphere and the most banter, if you want to use that kind of phrase. But in so many stadiums, Joe, I think the view behind the goal isn't great. Case in point, the Stadio Olimpico. I've been many, many, many times and sat in the Curva Nord or the Curva Sud with behind the goals. And I've done it. I've sat in that stadium on the halfway line where I prefer.
Yeah.
And the view's better, but the action is completely behind the goals. When you go behind the goals in these stadiums at the Olimpico, that's where the fans are smoking and shouting and drinking and fighting. And, you know, there's some soccer going on as well. So that it basically, I'm a little torn, but I would always say go on the halfway line. And going on, this is a new perspective for me, viewing from the corner and from the rafters in the corner.
But the thing is, sorry to jump in, Joe, but
no,
I don't think Taylor and I are disputing that the best view of the match as it is unfolding on the pitch is the halfway line. I think that is indisputable. Mm-hmm. But as a match-going fan, for the best experience where you're trying to mix having a good view of the match and also experiencing the atmosphere, that is what leads me to the corners, where you get, as Taylor said, the best of both worlds.
Okay, yeah, that's fair.
It also, maybe for me, is a little bit like the Brian Regan joke about how when you're the youngest kid, you get the worst seat in the car. So he just started calling the worst seat because then it made him feel like he had some control over it. Like, back seat, in the middle, on the hump. And I feel like for me, some of the MLS press boxes or the bigger like NFL press boxes start around midfield and then wrap around. And the the high-profile name journalists, they all get to sit around midfield, but maybe the less reputable you are, the further away from midfield you are, the closer to the corner, and that's where this guy sits. So I think maybe it's also just I've learned to accept that sitting in the corner is where I will be, so it's where I
want
to be.
I want the worst seat in
the press box. Exactly.
I want it. I call it. It's mine. I'll quickly toss my answer in because it's nothing. I don't fully know. Like, I haven't been to as many soccer games as a fan as I would like to, so I don't have a fully formed opinion, but I think I either want to be high enough, not in the press box, but high enough, like back a few rows to be able to see what's going on, maybe shaded towards one side or the other of the middle. Like, I'd still rather be closer towards the middle because then I can see everything. But I want to be high enough then that I actually can see everything, or I want to be really close. Like, I want to be down as in whatever the lowest row is to get the most like surreal experience of being this close to the field to actually see how absurd the stuff that these players do is. So I think I don't really want to be medium. I either want to be like up into the action, or I want to be a little bit further out and sort of shaded to one side or the other so I can see more of what's going on.
A man of extremes. I like it, Joe.
Yes.
Maybe we can say it depends on the stadium as well, because some stadiums, yeah, I've sat in the front row and where it's recessed a little bit, the camber of the field means you can't quite see the other side of the field when the ball's on the ground, for example. Yeah. And going back to the Olympico as well, because it's a circular stadium with a track, like behind the goal, the opposite goal feels like it's in a different zip code. And when you're in the corner, that's kind of exacerbated as well.
Yeah, it totally does depend on the stadium, because when I have gone to Orlando matches, I've not actually been lucky enough to stand in the wall behind the goal, but I've always thought next time I come, that's where, mm-hmm, I want to be. Whereas with Hampden and Olympico, the Stadio Olimpico, which are very similar stadiums in terms of the bowl structure, I avoid behind the goals at all costs.
Speaking of that, I want to pause for a moment. I will happily throw shade at Orlando as a city. I will not throw shade at Orlando City nor Orlando fans. I've seen some posts about how there was a lack of attendance, a lack of atmosphere for the USA's game against El Salvador. I'm not going to deny that or dispute that. I will say that, like, we talked on this show about how these weren't the most exciting games for any number of different reasons, but the World Cup qualifier in Orlando versus Panama that the U.S. just blanked Panama or beat them pretty handily, that atmosphere was rowdy, it was very loud, it was very intense, everybody was up for it. That stadium is excellent when everybody is up for it. When it's all-star game and people aren't quite as enthusiastic, maybe it's a quieter stadium, but I still think Orlando City has great atmosphere, and that wall, you're right, Graham, is pretty epic.
Good stuff. We won't hear any slander against Orlando as a city, by the way, Taylor. The host of MLS is back, of course, one of our favorite
yes,
tournaments
yes.
we've seen.
The concrete city.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. Derek, thank you very much for that question. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, plenty more. Back shortly.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Today's episode is brought to you by Shopify. On the Total Soccer Show, we often talk about the importance of a manager who can clearly and effectively communicate their tactics and then a squad of players capable of executing that approach, but also adding some individual flair along the way. And that's the same relationship you're getting with Shopify. You tell them how you want things to work or what you need to get done, and they execute the game plan, sometimes even better than you could have expected, with Shopify Magic, their AI-powered all-star. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage to the first real store stage, all the way to the did we just hit over a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. From what I've heard from family members who use Shopify for their online store, which has evolved into an amazing brick-and-mortar location, Shopify has helped with that growth, and with every step along the way, they've made it easier to process and track orders, run the business day-to-day, and help with long-term growth as well. So whether you're auctioning autographed jerseys or selling custom stadium prints, both of which are awesome, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% compared to other leading commerce platforms. And you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, the aforementioned AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States and is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, their extensive help resources are there to support your success every step of the way, because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial at shopify.com/TSS. That's all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/TSS now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. One more time, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/TSS.
Total Soccer Show, welcome back to Listener Questions. Zachary Bates has been in touch. Can someone please explain why Crystal Palace and Brighton are rivals? What other non-geographical soccer rivalries exist? So, Taylor, this is the Eagle-Seagull mm-hmm. Derby, which you have to say slowly, and you can't say quickly three times. Bird Derby. Derby to birds.
Yeah.
The M23,
it wasn't always.
It's the highway running between these two teams, which are not geographically close, as Zachary notes. And there are a few reasons for this rivalry, and one of them involves poop.
Yes, it does. Well said. The stage is set. I would add, what are they, like 41 kilometers apart?
Yeah, and an American term, this is a derby.
That's it. It's pretty close. But yes, for England, not as close. And then I don't know how apocryphal this is, but I did love that Brighton were originally the Dolphins and then changed to the Seagulls, with a lot of speculation that it was to annoy Crystal Palace, who had the Eagles at the time. But for my research, it dates back to 1976. Brighton, managed by Alan Mullery, Palace by Terry Venables. Both had been appointed in June 1976. Both had previously played together at Tottenham. And it seems like this is where some of the rivalry begins, that Mullery is made captain, Venables made vice captain, and there's a friendly competitiveness that maybe loses some of the friendliness as time goes on. These two playing in the third division at the time played each other five times that season. First one is a 1-1 draw. They draw against each other in the first round of the FA Cup. First two matches are draws. So we go to a third replay at Wembley. And there is a lot of questionable officiating in this one. Palace goes ahead 1-0. Brighton have a goal unfairly disallowed, according to both Brighton and I think some Palace supporters as well. Brighton then awarded a penalty near the end of the game. Brian Horton takes it and scores it. Referee whistles for infringement. Penalty is retaken and missed, and the point is consistently made that the only players who were in the box were Palace players, so it should not have been retaken. Mullery, the manager of Brighton, very angry, confronts the official as he's walking off, has various objects thrown at him, including a cup of hot coffee. He then, I think, throws change on the ground and says, "That's all your club is worth." And I think the rivalry is born. It gets more and more intense over time, including, as Ryan mentioned, in the 2012-2013 championship semifinal playoffs. In the second leg, Palace arrived to find excrement smeared all over their locker room. I don't know if they ever caught who did it, but Gus Poyet was very upset about it. He was then the Brighton manager. So angry that he, I think, like, sent a very angry email to the board, and they sacked him for it. I'm very confused by how all that played out, but it seems like
it's the board.
Exactly. It was them the whole time. But it does seem like one of these things where it's a small little thing that starts it, that little rivalry in the beginning, and then it builds and it builds and it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And this is, I think, one
and
of
then
the
there's poop
best.
On the walls.
And then there's poop on the walls. That's how it goes. Starts small, gets bigger, doesn't get checked. Eventually, we all know, inevitably, poop on the wall. I think this is one of the best stories of non-geographic rivalries, because there's just so many little incidents. There's other ones I've already gone plenty long talking about it, but so many little incidents that keep it sort of simmering and brewing. Even when they don't play each other for like 13 years, they're still actively rooting for the other to fail. So it seems like this is a pretty great example of this. Credit to Brighton and credit to Crystal Palace.
And Taylor, that video that you sent in our Slack chat last night, which I know this isn't ideal for an audio medium, but bizarre. I mean, it did a very good job of depicting the history of this rivalry, but it was almost like watching one of those dreams you have when you're ill.
It was
like Wallace and Gromit narrated by a sort of sinister Cockney.
I just
don't know if that's what I needed in my life.
To be clear, this video didn't have poop in it, by the way, just so we're clear. It was bit more innocent than that, in case that was where
only a little bit.
Yeah.
It felt quite sinister, weirdly.
By the way, I did not know, Taylor, that Brighton were the Dolphins. That's a good little factoid.
Because the seaside, Ryan. The seaside.
I'll tell you, I actually am a big aquarium nerd, and I know, having been to the Brighton Aquarium on the seafront many times, it was, I believe, the only UK aquarium to have dolphins in it back in the day.
So well, we're pausing the show here to go way into the weeds on this one. Ryan, what constitutes an aquarium nerd, I have to ask?
Every new city we go to, I insist we go to the aquarium.
Really?
Yeah.
Is that really a thing?
That's really a thing. And not even just since we've had kids. Like,
what are you looking for? Fish, just fish.
Yeah. How you evaluate which ones are good aquariums, which ones are bad aquariums? Tell us more.
We're getting into it, but I've always kept fish. I've had like saltwater fish and marine fish and stuff like in my home.
That explains the fish tank in my room in Brooklyn.
The Georgia Aquarium is my mecca. It is incredible.
You know that big aquarium that exploded in Berlin a few weeks ago? That was your fault, Ryan, wasn't it? That was somehow your fault. You were there at the scene.
I didn't do nothing. I would never do anything to harm the beautiful creatures of the sea.
Of course not.
Aren't fish just fish is the most Scottish take I think I've ever heard on aquariums, I have to say. Similar to George Costanza constantly calling whales fish. That feels like some great Graham Ruthven. Ryan, have you been to the Baltimore Aquarium, which I feel like is the sort of gold standard on the East Coast, but I haven't been there since I was like 5, so I don't know how good it actually is.
I've not been there, but I was very jealous. My wife went there on a school field trip, and she said it was an excellent aquarium. Surely on the East Coast, the Georgia Aquarium has to be do we call that East Coast?
Georgia is on the East Coast, yes.
I mean, Atlanta's not technically coastal, but...
Is it in Atlanta?
It's in Atlanta. It's right in downtown. Oh.
Anytime you can have an aquarium in a landlocked city, you gotta go for it.
It's got whale sharks. It's huge.
What? It has whale sharks?
Yeah, it's great. It's massive. It's massive.
Do they swim in aquariums full of Coca-Cola? Because that would really sort of bring the two cities together.
It is next to Coca-Cola World, so that is quite impossible. We've talked long enough about fish, though. Anyone have any extra non-geographical soccer rivalries to bring up here? I mean, Millwall Leeds, because their fans don't like each other very much, is one that springs to mind. Anything else, Graham?
Is that rivalry, not to put too fine a point on it, but is that rivalry just because both of their fans are traditionally, generalizing here, of a certain type, sort of hooligan-y, traditionally,
going down the years?
Is that the only reason?
That's it.
Okay, cool. Cool.
Yeah. I think I found a couple more. I think there are historical ones or historical strength rivalries. So Liverpool, Manchester United, obviously not the same city, but both of them have had so much success historically that they're the two of the biggest clubs in England. They're going to be rivals. Barcelona and Real Madrid, the same. And then on top of that is the historical connections of the Franco regime and everything involved there. I'll leave it at that. So I think you'll get some of that. The other couple that I thought were pretty interesting, St. Pauli, Hansa Rostock is not one that I was as familiar with until researching this one. St. Pauli, very leftist, very progressive, anti-racist, pro-LGBTQ+, anti-fascist. Hansa Rostock, located in the east, so more right-wing, more conservative a bit. There were fights in the stands in 1992 when these two played each other over riots and immigration issues, and they're now one of the most heavily policed matches in the world. I think it's one police officer for every 20 supporters when these two play each other. Another sort of historical rivalry that also touches on competitive rivalry would be Napoli versus Inter Milan. That dates back to the 80s when both clubs are vying for supremacy in the league. But Milan, northern, very cosmopolitan. The north of Italy is where the wealth has historically been, whereas Naples, seen as poorer. I talked about the Soprano scene. It's an excellent scene with Furio explaining why he hates the north, but it really does sort of give you an abbreviated history of Italy pretty quickly. So I think that would be another one that isn't geographic, but is sort of related to geography. Plenty of national team ones as well. And then I would throw in the Richmond Kickers having a rivalry with the Charleston Battery for who is the oldest continually operating team in the United States, amongst other things. That's a good one. And the Henny Derby of Richmond versus Ford Madison, two of the only clubs in USL to have black supporters groups. The two heads of those groups made a bet over which team would win, with the loser having to buy the winner a bottle of Hennessy, and it has continued since then. So those little rivalries as well, those sort of the little ones that pop up and then kind of grow from there, I also really enjoy.
I like that Richmond and Charleston have a rivalry based on continuous operation.
It's so nerdy.
They're rolling up their sleeves going, I've consulted this textbook, and it says this.
Oh, it's to like the day. Like I think Charlotte played on a Saturday, but Richmond maybe played on a Friday, and so there's much debate as to who did what. It does seem like most people will say that Charleston is the longest continually operating one, but then I think there's one indoor team that's been around since like the 70s, so I don't really know. It doesn't really matter. All I know is it did inform my dislike of Charleston from a young age.
Charleston has a lovely aquarium, by the way. Small, but albino alligators in there. Very good. Very good one to visit. Thank you, Zachary. Thank you to myself for revealing my Troy McClure-style enjoyment of the ocean animals.
I did not know this, and now I'm excited to learn more.
Oh, spin-off, you know, podcast.
Here can we agree, wherever we go next, the four of us, yes, whenever we're together, we're going to an aquarium, and Ryan is going to tell us his favorite things?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Beautiful. Beautiful.
I practically insist. Thank you, Zachary, for that question. Todd Metcalf has one here. Is XG the same from league to league?
Well, I'll see you later.
Just
get over your joke.
Is a shot from the top of the arc the same in the Premier League as it is in other leagues? And what constitutes a shot? Are blocked shots considered for XG? What about crosses that actually go on target? And Todd expands, at a recent Liverpool-Chelsea game, there were shots from outside the box near the arc that were collected near the touchline. They didn't even make it out for a throw-in. Do those count as well? Todd says he's just curious what actually is considered a shot. Joseph!
Okay, so thinking through, there's a lot of different questions here. I'm going to start with the first one, which I think is the hardest one and was the one that took me the most time to research and to learn more about, which is XG the same league to league? Or I think maybe a better way to phrase this, and you guys feel free to jump in anytime or to jump in if something doesn't make sense, because I'm still trying to wrap my head around some of this stuff. So is a shot's XG value from the top of the box in the exact same spot the same in the Premier League as it is in the Bundesliga, as it is in La Liga, as it is in MLS, as it is, you get the idea, right? So I think that's what's being asked here by Todd in that first question. So is that shot from the same spot in the same context worth the same from one league to the next? Basically, I didn't know the answer to this question. So I reached out to Kieran Doyle, who is a university soccer coach in Canada and does a bunch of really good work for American Soccer Analysis on the MLS side and on the NWSL side. Kieran's super smart and knows a lot of stuff. So this was his answer to basically me asking him this question. He said, good XG models, so the data models that decide what the XG values of these shots are, will include the league as a feature. And the model can sort of choose whether the league matters or not. So for a tap-in that's 1 inch away from the goal, you know, it might not matter what league you're in because that shot goes in like 99% of the time, regardless of where you are. But for a shot at the top of the box, maybe the model will decide that the league does matter. So I sort of followed up with him because my immediate thought was, well, basically, you know, how does the model decide? And isn't it just as simple as if a Premier League player takes a shot from outside the box, it's going to be a low quality chance, but it's probably going to be slightly higher than if an MLS player does it because generally speaking, Premier League players are better. So that's where my mind went first. It's probably more likely that Ruben Neves is going to hit that ball into the back of the net than it is for Noel Buck, 17-year-old American central midfielder for the Revs, right? But basically, that's not why. So that's what I asked Kieran. He's like, that's not really how it works. So he said, and this is the end of my spiel. I think we're almost to the bottom of this. He said, basically, when the model sees that that historically a certain kind of shot with the same characteristics, so maybe it is that shot from the top of the box, like, you know, 18 yards out, right after a counterattack. Like, let's add in all that context. The model can see that those kinds of shots, if they go in more often in the Premier League or in some specific league than they do in other leagues on average, then the model could flag that shot and say, like, actually, this shot that's usually worth, like, 0.01 XG is worth 0.02. Because in this league, in this context, based off of what the model knows from past shots, it actually does go in more often. So it's not necessarily like a player quality thing, which is where my mind went first. It's more so the model just zeroing in on a specific subset of data in a specific area and deciding whether or not that is a relevant factor. How the machine learning stuff goes and how the models are actually built, I can't speak to, but I think that answers at least the first bit of Todd's question.
Okay. So, yeah, that kind of aligns with the research I found. I do a bit of work with sports betting. And obviously in pricing for sports betting, they have to consider stuff like this. And this is a quote from a company called Tenstar, who do pricing for betting operators. And they say different XG models look at different levels of shot granularity. Simpler models look at whether the shot originated inside or outside the box, whereas more complex models look in greater detail at the angle of the shot or the method or the attempt, like if it's a header right. or a shot, in assigning the XG value. Other models look at the passage of attacking play that preceded the shot, the position of the goalkeeper, so on and so forth. So basically, yeah, confirming there that there are lots of different models, different nerds taking different right. things into different yeah. accounts.
Right, and one more thing, sorry, Taylor. I think in this case, from what I found, the where the shot is being taken from, sort of the Ryan, you mentioned the type of attack that precedes it, right? I think that's something you said, and I kind of mentioned with the counterattack yeah. versus, you know, other kinds of shots. You can factor that in. Some models, I think, are starting to factor in defender positioning as well, what body part the shot comes from. Essentially, the league, and from what I found, the league and what competition the shot's being taken in and what the past precedent is for shots of that type in that competition is like another feature of the model, just like shot location, attack speed preceding the shot, you know, angle, all that kind of stuff. It's like another factor that the model then decides whether to use or not, if it's relevant and if it would have a meaningful impact.
All right.
So is XG like coffee or wine for coffee or wine snobs, where broadly speaking, you might like people like it, but then there are certain leagues that do it better? Or like, will you find an XG snob whose MLS's calculations are off? They don't take into account angle the way they should. Like, will you get that level of nuance, do you think?
Oh, darling, you like Portuguese XG? No. You should have the French.
Well, the models will be established by the collectors, right, Joe? Rather than like the leagues yeah. themselves. So it'll be like Opta or StatsBomb mm-hmm. or what are some other ones?
Right. So same question then. But does that mean that you will get like, so, like, Joe, do you have a preferred, like, stats collector then, or stats aggregator, or?
Not really. It's a good question. I just don't know enough, and there's only so many that are available publicly. But there is an idea among data analysts that, like, the quality of information that you're getting, which is what this is about. XG is just another way to get information about soccer that hopefully helps you make better decisions. There is an idea among data analysts and people that are deeper into the space that some companies do a much better job of collecting accurate and useful information than others. So, yeah, I guess I wouldn't say it's like coffee or wine so much, because I think there is maybe more objectivity to it. You know, one person could appreciate a kind of coffee that another person doesn't like because of XYZ reasons. I think the same could generally be true with something like this, but I think there's also like pretty clear yeah. levels to it of some companies gotcha. Do a better job than others, just objectively speaking from people in the industry. Yeah.
And this isn't necessarily linked to XG, but through my kind of fantasy experience, I know that, for example, Opta records something like 800 different match events, so like different data points per match, where right. someone like Genius Sports, they're about 250 marks. Sport Radar is another one, they're up at about 700. So there's a variance between the collectors of how much they're actually collecting in each match.
Yeah, and Graham, that's the perfect segue, I think, to the rest of Todd's question as far as like what counts as a shot, basically. Do blocked shots count for XG? My answer to that is yeah, blocked shots do count for XG. And in general, it kind of just depends on who the poor person is that's writing down all the stuff from the game, right? Like if they decide, the way that a lot of this data is gathered for basic things like passes and tackles and stuff like that, is people watch the game and they code it, right? So it kind of depends on who the person is. If they judge that cross was a shot or if it was a cross, like they're going to decide to note things down in whatever way makes sense to them in that moment.
Graham, I've got a question. You mentioned some of the companies like Opta and Sport Radar, and I guess people like IMG, and there's a bunch of others who will collect data yeah. for games. Why would some collect noticeably fewer data points than others? Does that surely doesn't help them, right?
Because some of these collectors are catering to different markets. So for example, Genius is all about speed for sports, betting market. So Ryan, you'll be familiar with this. As soon as a team scores a goal, the market will be suspended. They enter what is called the danger zone on the back end, where they'll suspend all bets. They're primarily about speed, so that is, they're essentially pouring their resources into speed over you know, quantity of things.
Low latency.
Yeah, exactly. And Opta, who are kind of the Well, they used to be the gold standard, certainly, but they are more their database would maybe be used by analysts more than betting. They're more concerned with the amount that they're collecting. But there are bloodlines. I mean, Sportradar kind of straddle the two. They both provide data for analysts and for sports betting.
There we go. That's a very good question, Todd. So we learned that not all XGs were created equal, essentially, Joe.
Yep, true.
Yeah, there we go.
Accounted equal, yeah.
There we go. Thank you very much for that question, Todd. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, a little bit more.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX, stream on Hulu. Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer, if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Total Soccer Show, welcome back to our listener questions. Here's one from Michael Rodriguez, directed specifically at Graham Ruthven. When will the Scot from Plymouth Argyle, Ryan Hardy, get a call up to the national team? He's had tremendous form over the last 2 years, and Argyle is on the brink of promotion due to his goal scoring. Is he simply not good enough, or is he being snubbed? So Ryan Hardy played at youth levels for Scotland. Plymouth Argyle obviously looking pretty good. Promotion to the Championship looking reasonably likely. And Hardy leading the goal charge for them, Graham.
Yeah, and there's been a little bit of chat about Ryan Hardy. But I think it is quite speculative at this moment simply because he is playing in English League One. And right now, the fact of the matter is we don't have to go that low to find players. We used to have to go that low, going back a few years, but right now the squad's a pretty good place. That situation could change if Plymouth get promoted to the Championship. There is a spot up for grabs in the number nine pool because Che Adams and Lyndon Dykes have the first two places nailed down, and then that third spot sort of rotates between a few options, one of those options being Jacob Brown at Stoke City in the Championship. So it's not beyond the realms of possibility that if Hardy and Plymouth Argyle get up to the Championship and he continues his goal-scoring form, then he kind of forces his way in. But not right now, I would say. And also what's against Hardy is that Steve Clarke likes to have different profiles of strikers. So Che Adams is an all-round sort of facilitator, brings others into the game. Lyndon Dykes is a target man. Jacob Brown offers pace in behind. So you kind of need to prove you can offer something different. And while I watched quite a bit of Ryan Hardy when he was at Rangers, when they were in the lower leagues, he was at Raith Rovers as well, I believe. I seem to remember watching him. He might have played Stirling Albion a couple of times. Can't quite remember. He's got talent. He's a decent finisher, but his career has kind of been a bit of a slow burn. He must be, I don't have his profile in front of me, but he must be getting on like late 20s now, mid to late 20s now. So his career has been a bit of a slow burn, so I can understand why he hasn't really been on the radar that much.
All right, fair enough. That's interesting about picking from the lower leagues. I mean, England are pretty soon going to have to start picking from the lower leagues, but don't tell Jordan Pickford, it'll upset him.
I mean, Gareth Southgate, I saw his quotes about that he's going to have to start picking from the lower leagues. Come on, give me a break. Like, England have one of the deepest talent pools in all of international football right now. He cannot complain at this moment in time.
Is anyone shocked that that didn't end up being a shot at Scotland and Graham? I was fully convinced that that was going to be, but he'll never have to draw from somewhere horrific like... Scotland.
Ryan is
That's
still.
What I thought we were gonna do.
Taylor, Ryan is still on his aquarium high, so yeah, at the moment course, he's in his course. Happy place and doesn't have time to think of those insults.
That's exactly right. I was thinking about those rays swimming in the pool in I don't know Chicago's. Chicago's got a great aquarium, by the way. Right on the what do you call it? Large body.
Is this why you don't like Rome? Does Rome have a bad aquarium?
Rome doesn't have an aquarium, Graham.
There we go. We found out the reason. This is it.
It has a zoo and no aquarium, and they call this civilization. I don't know. Honestly, thank you very much, Michael, for that question. Let's move on to Diego Lara. If this Premier League season was based on kits, who would win who'd get top four and who would be relegated. All right, kit time. I'm going to kick off, Graham, with some relegation nominations for me. I don't know why I go negative first, but I have done. Bournemouth, I think, relegated. Oh. IRL and in Kitland as well. The zigzag stripes, the light purple away kits. No, they're going down.
That was my top in my top four. So we are starting on very different pages here. I would say it is a pretty poor season for kits in the Premier League this year. It's not a vintage year at all. So I did kind of struggle to pick a top four. So it's not that I think the Bournemouth one is a standout, outstanding kit. But yeah, I like the Bournemouth one.
Yeah, with that in mind, Graham, I feel like my relegated teams, it's a bad year for the Premier League in that way. It's sort of like lots of teams could be in the relegation zone because none of them are particularly standout. A lot of my viewing of the kits was left with me saying like, yeah, that's okay. Like none of them are, maybe a few of them are atrocious, and that's where I have my relegated teams. But for the most part, I have a lot of mid-tables like Spurs, who I like their home shirt, and then I think their away one is atrocious. Same for Liverpool a little bit. So very good and very bad averages out to mid-table for me.
I think there is one standout terrible kit, or certainly shirt, in the Premier League this season, and Taylor, you're not going to like.
It's Manchester United, because that has been being relegated.
I know. Yeah, it's that one.
Manchester United home is a bad, bad shirt this year. There's just way too much going on. It just doesn't work.
Oh yeah, it's definitely a camel. It's a horse designed by committee. I had them getting relegated for sure. They get a few points for having a collar on the home shirt. I love a Manchester United shirt with a collar, but
it's
patterns on the collar are ridiculous. The badge lining as well. I don't know why they did a crest on top of the badge, but then they made the filler the same color as the shirt. Questionable decisions with that one.
There's like pinstripes on it as well. There's the pattern on the collar. There's sort of like pinstripes embossed into the pattern. Then there's the crest within the crest. Camel is the perfect way to describe it. Yeah. I agree.
No, I had them bottom. I have Manchester United bottom for relegation in shirts. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. The black shoulder stripes with the white collar with too much detail on it. Yeah. It's not doing it for me. Joe, what's doing it for you in this Premier League kit league?
Okay, so for me, the pretty clear top of the league, which also aligns with how things have been going this season, is Arsenal. I really like Arsenal's combination. The home, red shirt, it's classic, but the white collar I really like as well. I'm a sucker for a jersey with a collar. I really like it. So I'm a fan of the home kit. And then the black and gold away kit is nice. It's really, really nice. It looks cool. I'm not as big a fan of the third kit, the light pink, but a lot of these third kits are kind of out there. So in general, I really like that one. Man City, I thought, isn't bad either. Arsenal's the only one that I'm actually passionate about. The rest, I think, are kind of mediocre. Man City, the blue with white and red trim is growing on me. And the black and red diagonal stripes on the away kit are nice as well. So I like those. A couple ones that I don't enjoy, Manchester United in my relegation zone. Leeds United, did anybody have Leeds close to the bottom? Their white home kit is boring. I know it's traditional, but it's boring. And the neon yellow and blue tie-dye, I don't even have words to describe that. Yeah. Weston McKennie is the only person I've seen that even look kind of sort of good on. And if that's the bar's too high, folks. It's just bad.
Joe, that's a really good way of explaining the Leeds home shirt, because I struggled with that as well, that historically they're wearing all white, but you can have an all-white kit that still elevates and looks sharp versus an all-white kit that looks like, oh, you just had to do an all-white shirt, so you went with that. It is pretty basic. I actually like the tie-dye one a bit more. And sort of when we come to different colors being thrown in, I like West Ham a lot. I like the home one. It's a throwback to them winning promotion. I like the graffiti shoulders, but then the black away, it has the kind of geometric bright trim on the sleeves. I think that's a pretty interesting one. They were in my top four. So was City. So were Villa, who I think are traditional but clean and not boring. So I had Arsenal, Villa, City, and West Ham as my top four.
That's nice. I'm going to throw a few other names out there. I'm going to throw shade on Leicester. They've got the gold Adidas and crest. They've got the collar with a V-neck on it. The sponsor is FBS Trade Online. It's just Helvetica. They've not even tried at all with that logo. So that's terrible. And it's massive as well. The sleeve sponsor's massive. So that one's not doing anything for me. Graham, I don't know if this is controversial, but I really like Newcastle's kits. All three of them. The Castor ones. The home shirt has got the nice round neck, which is what you expect from Newcastle. The stripes are the correct thickness, which they haven't been necessarily in seasons gone past. And the second and third kits, it's this really nice blue and yellow kit they got as their away kit. And then we're not allowed to like it, but the Saudi Arabia...
Yeah. So that's the thing about that kit. Obviously, there are other connotations with that kit. But if it is possible, and I'm not sure that it is, but if it is possible to separate the kit from those connotations, that is a good kit. It aesthetically looks good. And I agree with Newcastle having the stripes the same width and the same number of them rather than having like three they've had in recent seasons, which hasn't worked at all for Newcastle United. The only issue with their kits is I believe a lot of their fans have had issues with like production quality issues. So they will buy one of those shirts from Castor, who are a new brand, a new kid in the block, and I don't think they've quite ramped up their production facilities yet. And so you will see cases of the badge being upside down. And I think Wolves have actually had similar things. They had a match, they played a real-life Premier League match with the badge, the Wolves badge, upside down on their shirt because Castor are still getting used to being a Premier League kit supplier.
Or it's just a cry for help. When you fly the flag upside down, it's a sign of crisis. So maybe if you fly the badge upside down, it's a sign that things aren't okay behind the scenes.
That was towards the end of Bruno Lage's tenure as manager, and that was the player sending a message, SOS.
True kit story, by the way. I went to the first ever game at Pride Park, Derby's stadium, in 1997-98, I'm going to say. So obviously Wimbledon were playing there. It was near the start of the season. And the kit,
you're a Wimbledon fan?
Yeah, I've not mentioned it. I like aquariums in Wimbledon. The kit only just come out, and... It transpired that the team hadn't travelled with enough kits for the substitutes. So a player came on, they didn't have a kit. So rather than borrowing one from another player, they came to the away supporters and said, has anyone got the replica and we could borrow it? So
they went to the fans.
Yeah. So our fullback, Alan Kimball, came over and wore a replica shirt with no number on it. And we got a fine for it, apparently, because it was a Premier League game. And he was wearing a replica
shirt. I would say deserved, to be honest. It feels like that negligence should be punished. But I like to think that the players were having to find fans with their name on the back of shirts. Yeah. And so like the right backs and the centre backs were being dealt a blow to their self-esteem when they couldn't find one with their name on the back.
Yeah, there you go. I still remember how jarring it was watching a professional soccer player on the field with no name or number on the back when everyone else had one. It was quite...
I thought you were going to say that Derby gave you their away kits, which I have seen before. I can't, off the top of my head, I can't think where I've seen that, but I have seen that before where the away team wears the home team's away kits.
That's happened. We've had referees wear like a training drill top for a team, haven't they, when that's clashed. I think we've seen that once or twice before as well. One more team. Have we mentioned Crystal Palace?
Yeah, so they're top of my list. I haven't actually said my top four yet, but the Crystal Palace are top of my list for home and away. They're kind of, Taylor's not a fan.
Yeah, I wasn't either.
Did you not say you liked the West Ham one with the graffiti on the shoulder? Is it not a similar sort of vibe?
Because it's an
Crystal
accent.
Palace one?
It's not the entire focal point of the jersey that looks very much like, someone's toddler designed a shirt. Here's some squiggles.
No,
put it on.
The Crystal Palace one is good, and I like the symmetry of the home and away one. It's basically just inverted, which sometimes I'm not a massive fan of that when the away kit is the same as the home kit, but for some reason it works with this one. I also have to mention Everton because they're Hummel and all Hummel kits are nice, and I like the little detail of embossed throughout the shirt is the Everton tower. So if you look at their badge, the tower is in the Everton badge, and they've taken the tower, the outline of the tower, and they've kind of embossed it as a pattern throughout the shirt, which is very nice.
Well, and they're trying to get rid of that in their crest a year or two ago anyway. They tried to redesign it, and then the fans said no, and they went, okay, sorry.
Yeah, they did try to redesign their crest, but I think they wanted the crest to only be the tower, I think, was the crest.
Does anyone else have issue with Nottingham Forest? Like, I know they don't have the shirt sponsor, but they look fully like a team that weren't licensed and were just put into the Premier League this season. And then
Pro Evo Forest.
And then their away one looks like they stole it from... Yes, exactly. It looks like they stole it from St. Vincent. No, I would say like they wanted Brazil, but Brazil was too expensive. So St. Vincent was on clearance and they were like, yeah, we'll take that. Like, I don't love the two color combinations.
Yeah.
I would like to like Nottingham Forest more because they don't have the shirt sponsor, but it just looks sort of knockoff to me.
The red, Taylor, just looks like you would go and buy it at Ross. Like,
it really does.
It's so plain. Like, you could pick
really
it up for
does.
$12, $12.99. Yes.
You do not want to walk around Target wearing that shirt because you'll get a lot of people asking where stuff is.
Exactly.
One other team we haven't mentioned, of course, AC Richmond. Graham, I like the orange away kit they wore at Chelsea. What do you think about the home kit?
Yeah, I actually own AFC Richmond merchandise. I wore an AFC Richmond hoodie to my last Stirling Albion match. So I like to believe it's given me luck.
I bought the orange shirt. I did.
Did you?
Yeah, I did. I like it.
That's nice.
Yeah, very good. Very good. All right. I think that just about covers our kit thoughts. Thank you very much, Diego, for that question. And thank you for everybody who has submitted a question for this here listener questions. We appreciate you all. TotalSoccerShow.com/questions if you'd like to contribute. But in the meantime, Taylor Rockwell, thank you very much, sir. I like Riff Raff 2 a little bit. Not as much as John Mayer, though.
I appreciate that. I like whale sharks. So there you go.
Who doesn't? Graham Rudson, thank you very much, sir.
Thank you, Ryan Bailey.
And Joseph Lowery, pleasure as always, my good man.
Right back at you, Ryan.
And listener, thank you again for joining us on this journey. We'll be back on the feed very shortly, but for now, bye!
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. Place your first bet on any game and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.